And welcome. This is Nathan Ruggles here with you, and it's time for The Point of Pittsburgh here with Union Edge Labor's Talk Radio. Thanks for joining us. We're going to be talking about labor history from a local perspective here and news from the Steel City. And I have with me, as always, pleasure to have you both in the studio here, Rosemary Trump, former National VP of SEIU. Rosemary.
And it's a pleasure and always good to be here. Thank you.
And the historian of Pittsburgh, excuse me, with the Battle of Homestown Foundation, Charlie McAllister. Charlie, thanks
Great
for being
to be
here.
Here.
Well, I understand that we're going to start off here talking about some news out of Point Park University with some organizing efforts that have been very long in the development.
Absurd. And here's the, you know, well, first of all, the full-time 140 faculty members at Point Park University here in Pittsburgh was able to reach its first ever union negotiated contract on behalf of those professionals. And the union that has been representing them is the Newspaper Guild here in Pittsburgh. And bless them, because these faculty members voted for a union over 13 years ago.
And
13 years.
Is that a record?
It's a near record, I think, really. I mean,
not a record you want, though.
No.
I think.
In 2004, they voted 49-14. Not a small majority, but an overwhelming majority. They voted by 49-14 to be represented by the Newspaper Guild. And yet the Point Park filed an exception with the National Labor Relations Board and kept them tied up, you know, appeal after appeal after appeal. You know, my theory is they probably looked at their legal costs for those 14 years being billed at anywhere from probably $400 to $600 an hour by the firm.
Sure,
this is all supposition on my part
as being a former
union organizer and representative.
That's why you're here, because you have the insight.
I bet in those 14 years, they got billed close to anywhere between $1 and $2 million by that law firm.
Incredible.
Isn't that incredible?
Instead,
and they figured out that if they gave every one of those faculty people a $10,000 a year raise, they would have saved a $500,000 or $2 million or whatever it is. But somebody ought to look at that question.
No, I think it's an excellent, excellent question, because in hindsight, too, are they going to look back and think, if we could have spent that $1 million or $2 million on investing in our faculty, investing in our staff,
right,
and making not only their lives better, but making a better environment for students at the university, which is their job.
Right. Exactly. So. No, because it's true. I mean, one of the motivating reasons why the faculty really got serious about putting pressure on the administration about getting a contract is exactly what you said, Nathan. It was because they were cutting the staff and cutting the wages of the workers, creating a huge morale problem, such a huge morale problem that this week they voted to affirm and ratify their contract. Last week they voted a non-confidence vote in their president of Point Park College, because what they wanted was a greater voice in academic affairs and a greater voice in the management of the college, and they voted to censor their college president for not providing the sufficient leadership he should be providing in addressing those issues of paying people appropriately, as well as keeping sufficient staff available to provide a quality education for all those students. So hooray for the union, hooray for all those faculty members that stuck with it for 14 years.
My goodness, absolutely.
And the Newspaper Guild, who represented them during that period to get this opportunity. But I think this is a wonderful example, you know, for all faculty, including the Pitt professors that are in the process of organizing, the Pitt University professors, because essentially, you know, all those professors have this similar interest, which is being able to, you know, to seek greater academic freedom and better working conditions with management, as well as addressing their issues of wages, hours, and conditions of employment. And there's really no other effective way to be able to do that securely and with confidence and with the ability to make a difference other than joining with your coworkers in advocating on behalf of all of those workers who are similarly situated. So hooray for them.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it's too bad. It certainly did take too long because it's going to take a minute to try to turn around the relationship, which can be poisonous, wouldn't you say, Charlie?
There's a couple of interesting things. I mean, one is that Duquesne University has been stonewalling and using appeals and to the NLRB and then to courts to block an overwhelming vote of their faculty.
So not a dissimilar situation.
It's a similar situation. And then it was interesting at Point Park that the adjuncts actually beat the regular faculty in terms of getting a contract. So the adjuncts organized with the steelworkers and were able to get a contract. And I remember going to a meeting of the steelworkers and the adjuncts, and it was a very inspiring meeting because the gaining of a contract there, people who had been, the negotiating committee was made presentations. Every one of them had interesting stories. But the theme that ran through them all was, finally, we have free speech. That we can actually, we used to have to close the door and say the U word in, you know, in whispers behind.
Which is, it's so sad that's too often the case, right?
Yeah, because you could get fired for just talking about a union. And so now they can.
And adjuncts are disposable, right?
Now they could tell their students what they were making as opposed to what the students were paying, which was so. Once they hit 60% of the people had signed union cards, even before they got the contract, they felt a new freedom to speak, to tell the truth about their own lives, about their struggle to be a good teacher for their students. And they got overwhelming support among the students.
Fantastic.
Because the students were saying, my God, you won't make this little. You have so little power over your lives. This is how you're being treated. They got a contract before the regular faculty was being tied up legally in the process. So there's a lesson here, and I think that's what the lesson that the steelworkers are taking is that you want to organize wall-to-wall at the University of Pittsburgh, which includes adjuncts, includes graduate assistants, includes regular faculty in one big union organizing drive.
And truly, I think the courage and the lesson of Point Park management side is that when you spend 13, 14 years winding your way through appeals at the National Labor Relations Board and then going to the district court once the NLRB rules against you, and then you spend, you know, hundreds of thousands, if not millions of dollars in legal fees to get through the district court process appeal. And then after you lose there, you go to the U.S. Court of Appeals, the Third Circuit, and you lose there. And then your next step is the Supreme Court. You're going to have $5 million in legal fees. In the meantime, you could build a new university with that kind of money.
do you think that Duquesne or Pitt will look across to downtown and see this experience at Point Park and have a change of heart? I mean, is there any possibility?
I really think there's a strong possibility that, you know, with the students and the faculty being able to see the results of this example, they should learn from it. You know, we always say learn from your experience and your history. Well, Pitt should learn from Point Park's experience and history and use it as a case study and really decide, you know, that the right thing to do legally, morally, ethically, and for good management reasons and good morale reasons and for quality education reasons is to do the right thing, recognize the union, bargain in good faith, and come to a contract.
Sounds good. Well, we'll keep an eye on that. And when that comes to pass, we'll be talking about it here on The Point of Pittsburgh. We are going to need to take a break here, but coming up next, I know we're going to talk about the electrical workers here in town. But I have with me Rosemary Trump and Charlie McAllister. This is Nathan Ruggles here with you on The Point of Pittsburgh. We'll be back here in just a moment.
Although President Trump dodged military service in his youth, he certainly is militaristic. He's bellicose, likes to issue commands, and is constantly firing off militant tweets at anyone he perceives to be an enemy, which seems to include everyone who dares to disagree with him. Meanwhile, he and his White House full of military commanders are pondering the launch of a real shooting war, a military offensive that would be known as Trump's War. Actually, he would be attempting to achieve battlefield glory by picking up and extending what at first was Bush's war, then Obama's war. The place is Afghanistan, and the strategy is to shove another 5,000 or so American soldiers, none of whom will be named Trump, into that brutish hellhole. Yes, that mess is still boiling, despite President Obama's 2012 pledge to end U.S. involvement. After 16 years, the longest war in our history, after more than 2,000 Americans killed and 20,000 others maimed, after more than $800 billion spent on it, 8,400 of our troops are still there. The killing continues, and we taxpayers keep pumping $3 billion a month into the insanity. For all of that, the Taliban forces we've been trying to defeat are stronger than ever, and the Afghan government we're supporting is as corrupt, inept, and despised as ever. Nonetheless, Trump is violating a basic rule of civilian control of the military. Never ask the generals if they need more resources. This president has surrounded himself with generals and surrendered crucial decision-making authority to them. This is Jim Hightower saying, "We weren't able to win in Afghanistan when 100,000 of our troops were there. So what do we win by putting 5,000 more soldiers in harm's way, other than more U.S. casualties? If Trump can't tell us that, we should tell him no."
The average time a resume spends on an HR manager's desk is 7 seconds, and most of them are tossed aside. Now imagine if one of those resumes belonged to Yasmin, who was
living in a shelter, juggling 3 jobs. I had to be resilient. That's something that you can't teach.
We rely so much on a resume, yet it could never tell the full story of someone who
had to be independent and take initiative, and that's how I handle every project I get.
Discover new ways to develop great talent at gradsoflife.org, brought to you by Grads of Life and the Ad Council.
I'm more resourceful than I thought.
My suit can still make an impression.
My video games are still game changers.
And my lamp can bring others a bright future.
Because when I donate my stuff to Goodwill,
it helps fund job placement and training for people right in my community.
Now my stuff gets a second chance.
And will give someone in my community
a second chance too.
Goodwill. Donate stuff. Create jobs. Find your nearest donation center at goodwill.org. That's goodwill.org. This message brought to you by Goodwill and the Ad Council.
And we're back here on The Point of Pittsburgh. This is Nathan Ruggles here with you. And as always, I have sitting with me here in the studio today the former National VP of SEIU, Rosemary Trump. Rosemary, thanks for being here.
Always wonderful to be here. Thank you, Nathan.
And we have the historian with the Battle of Homestead Foundation, Charlie McAllister. Charlie.
Great to be here.
Now, next on the docket here today with news is the electrical workers are in town at the convention.
Right. That's one of the, of course, there's the old industrial electrical workers, which this is a representation of. Of course, there's the electrical workers, the IBEW, which is the people that...
Not to be confused.
Yes, not to be confused that, you know, put electrical facilities into buildings and who string lines to, for transmission. Those are that's IBEW. But the old electrical manufacturing industry, when the CIO was formed, was the third largest union and had over nearly 500,000 members after World War II. But it under accusations of communist leadership, the union was split into the UE and IUE. The IUE has since joined, I think, the Communication Workers of America. But the UE is
right.
Still out there, and it's a very, they were the union at my old facility, Union Switch and Signal, and I went with my very good friend, the former chief steward of the Westinghouse Air Brake. We were chief stewards of the two sister plants, both part of UE Local 610, and we gave a talk to young activists, UE, about 25 of them from around the country, now mostly in public sector or in small manufacturing facilities, plastics, but the big thing that the convention is dealing with is the closing or the gradual closing of the great plant in Erie, Pennsylvania, of the locomotive works of GE for years and years. It was the prime supplier of locomotives to American railroads.
The substantial facility we're talking about.
Yeah, I think at its peak it probably had 10,000 employees. It certainly, even in recent years or a decade ago, had 5,000. I think it's down to about 500.
So a shadow of its former self.
Right, and they have opened a facility to build the locomotives in Texas. It'll be a non-union facility. And what is just as important as the lower wages that they'll get with non-union folks is that they will be able much more freely to subcontract to Mexico and to China, which is something that the UE fiercely resisted up at up in Erie, wanting to maintain the integrity of the product and the quality of the work. And that facility was an extremely efficient and excellent facility. We'll see. I'm almost certain to see both a cheapening of the product, certainly, but also a decline in its quality by losing the total control, which was exercised in the past by that one plant. So this is a international...
So that one plant was able to oversee the whole process.
Right, exactly. So they're going to see a great decentralization. And that's what Westinghouse Electric went through years ago, and it led to the decline and almost destruction of Westinghouse Electric. So... disintegration is not necessarily a great, it might work in the short run to cut costs and make some money in the short run, but it has been proven to be a very bad tactic in the long run. So a shout out to the UE conventioners who are in town this week, but we had a great session with the young activists. And it was a very exciting, dynamic discussion with them and the kind of world that they face with the nature of work itself changing so rapidly. So,
well, unfortunately, it wouldn't be the first time that corporate America was short-sighted in terms of their company.
Short-term gain is the name of the game.
That's right. Yeah. And this is, there's a larger issue here, even beyond these electrical workers, of that we should mention, of companies, you know, taking advantage of people desperate for jobs in areas across the country, and in this case, Texas.
Yeah, interesting. I wonder if it's Houston. Yeah, I don't know where they're going. I don't know where that is.
But this is a large issue, right?
Yeah,
that we're seeing.
Sure. Absolutely. I know Rosemary has something.
Yeah,
to add.
I have good news. Yeah. I actually have good news. How often do we get to report good news? And the good news is that, you know, the unions won. Workers won in the courts for a change. The state Supreme Court of Pennsylvania just put out a ruling that the procedure by which employers were able to negate 21 years ago in 1996, where if you were severely injured, say you were up on a roof, you know, repairing a roof and you fell off the roof and you broke your back.
On the job.
And you broke your back and, you know, you couldn't legitimately walk again or climb up those ladders again to take more roofs off. That if you were permanently injured or severely injured, you know, what the law prior to 1996 said, you know, you would be able to collect workers' compensation to make up your lost wages and your benefits for the rest of your life. And the reason the unions legislated that workers' comp law to protect all workers in a working situation from, you know, severe injury was so that workers didn't have to file a civil suit to say, you owe me millions of dollars, you know, after 5 or 10 years of litigation for that injury, and employers didn't have to come up with millions of dollars.
And this is not just union workers we're talking about,
no,
right?
No, this is union workers negotiating for all workers.
That's right.
Legislatively. But it was the unions that initiated the legislation and got it passed. That we've had, you know, workers' compensation laws from the, 1920s, Charlie? Or
1914, I think, in Pennsylvania.
In Pennsylvania, yeah. 1914.
One of the earliest.
Great. So here's the deal, though. In 1996, the employer said, we're paying too much money for these people to have lifetime benefits and lifetime earnings as a result of these injuries. We want to limit our exposure to these lifetime payouts for lost wages and benefits. And the Republican legislature and the Republican governor at that time signed a bill saying, okay, after 2 years of a worker being on workers' compensation, the employer can, the insurance company can ask to have the somebody that's paid by them from the AMA examine that worker and determine whether or not they are still 50% or more disabled and can't go back to work somewhere. Well, what happened, of course, and the union saw that happening, is that there would be many workers that would go back and say, oh, well, you might not be able to go back up on a roof again, but you can find some type of work because you can walk and talk. And unfortunately, though, those workers would be cut off of their benefits at that point, and they would have to go out and find a fast food job or something that, you know, that paid them much less than what they were earning prior to then, and really wasn't fair, because while they could walk or talk, they walked and talked in pain. You know, if you break your back, you're going to have lifetime pain. I'm sorry. I mean, they're rare do you find somebody recover from a very severe injury of that type.
Well, and if I'm hearing you right, too, the companies are paying the people that are going in and doing these examinations.
Right. They're right. They're so, on a panel. And they, right. Exactly. And
so, you know, that's obvious.
Exactly.
They're never going to be biased, right?
No, no, of course not. So in any event, the Supreme Court, and by the way, over that 20-year period, not only did their worker compensation cost, you know, have working compensation cost stayed the same. Oh, no. They did lessen by 62%. In other words, the worker comp, I mean, what in the last 20 years has gone down 62%? Not too many items in the market basket. And so what that
prices
means
for things you have to buy to and to
exactly
sustain your life and that
right
of your family certainly have gone up.
But that's, nevertheless, what it meant is that workers were unfortunately being shuttled off the rolls of worker compensation and forced in a position of having to find some type of work to make up those lost benefits to their peril. And yes, the companies benefited because they were able to not pay money into the workers' compensation
sure
system.
Now, we're coming close to the end of our time, but we
yes
have the good end
the
of
good,
the story.
The
right?
good end of the story is two things. Is one is that the state Supreme Court threw that out and said it that they don't have the right to delegate. The insurance company doesn't have the right to delegate that to this AMA panel. And two, for anybody that's out there that was eliminated from their worker compensation after the 2 year period by an employer, they can refile again. So listen up. If you got a parent or an uncle or you know you yourself out there were taken off of worker compensation because of some panel doctor saying, oh no, you are 51% better, and therefore you got to go back to work, you can go back and have your case reviewed to see if you're legitimately entitled to receive that disability payment that you were cheated out of as a result of this panel of doctors that may have made a mistake about your evaluation.
Well, it took 21 years, but it's good to hear some good news in that
yes
area,
indeed.
So. Well, that'll have to do it here for today on The Point of Pittsburgh. Thank you both once again, as always, for coming in. It's great to talk to you both. Charlie McCollister, thank you for being here.
Great to be here.
And Rosemary Trump, thank you as well.
Thank you.
And this is Nathan Ruggles here with The Point of Pittsburgh. Thanks for listening.